Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Today we have a number of bills for public hearing, and at this point I think we're going to be just kind of working down the list as it's presented on the agenda. So we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 385.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 385 modifies exclusions from augmented estate to distinguish irrevocable transfer of property before death and transfers of property on or after death with the conjoining or consent of surviving spouse, and to include property held by either spouse in a solely fiduciary capacity, permits value of non-probate estate to be determined after administration expenses, allows property held by decedent immediately before death to be included in non-probate estate only to the extent that the decedent could designate either self or spouse as beneficiary, allows decedent's non-probate transfers to surviving spouse to be included in surviving spouse's estate, clarifies that provisions governing valuation of trusts that benefit a surviving spouse apply to trusts created by the decedent's spouse, and for valuation of other trusts, references ORS 114-630 sub 3 and 4, permits will, trust, or other instrument of decedent's spouse to control satisfaction of balance of elective share, applies retroactively to January 1, 2011, declares an emergency effective on passage. This bill comes from the Estate Planning and Administration section of the Oregon State Bar. It is described as technical and corrective in nature. It modifies current law on elective share established by House Bill 3077 in 2009, which resulted from work of the Oregon Law Commission and took effect January 1st of this year.
All right, thank you. We have two people that have scheduled or signed up on the registration for giving testimony today, Jeff Moore and Wendy Johnson. If you could come forward, please. And while they're coming forward, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 385? Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Moore. I'm representing the Executive Committee of the State Planning Section of the Oregon State Bar. And Chairperson Ross, the introduction there sounded extremely complex. So let me just sort of go through this a little bit, give a little bit of context as to exactly what we're doing here. This law is already in place. These are some technical corrections to try to make it more in sync with what the intent was. Basically, the public policy is a protection for, say, the impoverished spouse. There's nothing that says that anybody needs to leave anything to any particular person in their will or trust, but in the event there is a marriage and the decedent spouse does not leave anything to the surviving spouse, Oregon law gives that surviving spouse the ability to make an elective share. Now, under the old law, they were allowed to make a fixed fractional share of 1/4 share of the estate, but only if it was the probate estate. Now, just to clarify, between probate, everything can pretty much fall into two categories, probate and non-probate. Probate are assets that pass under somebody's will. Non-probate assets are basically everything else. So it was very easy to make a plan where you could effectively disregard the elective share by simply doing a living trust or naming a non-spouse on an IRA or the insurance, etc. So it's very easy to totally get around this. This new House Bill 3077 was passed in 2009, trying to make this a fairer bill, a fairer law. And the idea was to say we are going to actually connect it to the duration of the marriage. And we're going to actually bring both probate and non-probate assets into this pool of division to make it a little more fair for the potentially impoverished spouse. In addition, if the spouse was not impoverished, then there's really no need to go ahead and give them a share of perhaps the decedent spouse who maybe was more impoverished than the surviving spouse. So that law was passed. It was given an effective date for deaths following December 31st, 2010. The practitioners would be given basically a year to review this and make sure that everything was going to happen as according to plan. But there were a few things that needed to be corrected, a few overreaching items. First off, the first correction basically states that if somebody is to make a transfer prior to death, a gift, that that's not going to be brought back into the estate of the decedent. So, for example, if I make a gift to a child a few years prior to my death, that's not going to be included in my the augmented estate. In addition, if I'm solely holding assets as a fiduciary, so for example, a trustee, I'm the trustee of my parents' trust, I don't necessarily have any ability to access those or anything else. Those assets will also not be included in the augmented estate of the marriage. The second correction is that the law allowed for the probate assets to be reduced by any debts or administrative expenses. So basically what's going to be included in the estate would be net, which makes sense. However, there was no similar provision for the non-probate assets. And so the second correction basically states that the non-probate assets will be treated the same. In addition, there's a power of appointment provision that basically says if the decedent had a power to appoint some property but not to himself or herself or to the surviving spouse, that likewise will not be included in the marital or the augmented estate. At the recommendation of legislative counsel, there was some duplicative language that was removed that really should have been in a different section. With respect to the surviving spouse's estate, for example, it is going to include anything that they did, in fact, receive from the decedent spouse. So the surviving spouse's estate is modified to include any assets, probate assets, received from the decedent, any non-probate assets received from the decedent, a percentage of trusts that were created by the decedent for the survivor, 100% if the spouse was able to access income and principal, 50% if the surviving spouse was only able to access income. In addition, there's some clarification that those valuations and trusts will be valued in the same manner for estate tax purposes. The last main correction really is that the state default says if the surviving spouse is to receive payment from the decedent's share of the assets, the state default says that it will be pro rata with respect to any and all beneficiaries other than the surviving spouse who received assets. That's the default. That's still in play. But this allows the decedent to give priority to those payments. So, for example, if there is a disabled child for whom a trust has been established, and then maybe some provisions for a charitable distribution, the decedent can spell out in their own estate plan that any elective share can be paid, say, from the charitable portion as opposed to this portion I've set aside for a disabled child. It just gives a little more discretion to the decedent. And as was mentioned, the idea is to make this effective on passage so that we try to get everybody onto the same plane and the same treatment. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
All right. Wendy, yes. Additional information?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. I've submitted the written testimony. It tracks with Jeff Moore's testimony on what each section does. Just provided a little more background on why the commission had done the original legislation in 2009 with House Bill 3077. But this really is a technical corrections bill that the commission reviewed and supports as well.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Cruz.
I find this confusing.
That's why Jeff took his time and we talked very slowly.
I know. This has very little to do with farming.
And the bullet points that Wendy's given us really does help too.
But a simple question. I'm married. My wife and I have been separated for years. We just never got divorced. And I don't want to give her anything because she's an evil person. This is hypothetical, by the way. And so I choose to leave. I don't want to give her anything. I choose to leave everything to my kids. Does this impact that?
Senator Cruz and Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my understanding is that if there is still a legal marriage, then this law applies. Now, it seems like there was some discussion, and I'll have to go back and review the entire bill in its entirety, but Wendy, I don't recall that there's
prenups
a separation.
Prenups and postnups are okay.
What's that?
Prenups and postnups are okay.
Yeah, but as far as separation, just pure separation, you're still legally married at
right.
that time. But I should make a comment, though, that in the event that there is a prenuptial agreement or even a postnuptial agreement, this law can be waived by the agreement of both spouses. And so if there's a separation agreement, typically that separation agreement will specify you waive your right to the elective share, I waive my right to the elective share.
Interesting. Well, I mean, it's just kind of, to a degree, it's kind of limiting what I can do with my assets.
Well, that's kind of the law right now.
I know.
All right. Other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Again, I'll check to see if anyone else wanted to give testimony on 385. Not seeing anyone come forward, we'll close our public hearing. We'll open up the next one on Senate Bill 386.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 386 excludes property gifted to and held separately by one party to a dissolution of marriage from presumption of equal contribution that applies to marital assets. Senate Bill 386 is submitted jointly by the Estate Planning Section and the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Law.
All right, thank you. I have three people that have signed up. Russ Lepetsky, Eric Velterlin, and then Bill, Hal, is what I think it's going to be versus Home. Can't tell if it's a W or an M. Those three want to come forward. Thank you. Whoever would like to start it, give us your name and testimony, that'd be great.
Thank you. Chair Brozanski, members of the committee, my name is Russ Lepetsky. I'm here on behalf of the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. On my left is Eric Vetterlein, who is the chair of the Estate Planning Section of the Oregon State Bar. On my right is Bill Howe, who is an attorney in private practice in Portland, and I think we'll all be saying a few words, but I'll start. Senate Bill 386 is a bill that arises out of the intersection of the estate planning world and the domestic relations world, and what it does, in short, is it creates a presumption, a rebuttable presumption, that an asset that is acquired during the marriage by gift or inheritance and continuously held separately by the recipient spouse is rebuttedly the separate property of that spouse upon the dissolution of the marriage. It's that simple and that straightforward. That's the substantive change to the law that the bill makes. There is a second housekeeping change that the bill makes in simply breaking down one of our unwieldy family law statutes into discrete sections that are subject matter based. ORS 107.105 has over the years been amended repeatedly with little thought given to where those amendments are actually stuck into the statute, and one sub-paragraph of that particular statute is badly in need of some work, and so this bill, without making any substantive changes to the statute, breaks it down into some common sense sub-paragraphs. That's what the bill does, and I'm certainly happy to answer questions, and the gentleman flanking me may well have their own comments.
All right. Whoever would like to go next, we'll take all the testimony and then open up for questions.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Eric Vetterlein. I'm the chair of the Estate Planning and Administration section of the Oregon State Bar, and the executive committee of that section has supports this bill and has approved it. Along with the family law section, we've worked jointly on this project together, and I would echo the testimony given by Mr. Lepetsky. I won't repeat it, but we join in with it also. I guess I just want to expand a little bit from the estate planning point of view. As he mentioned, this is affects both family law and estate planning. It's intended to change a court case or the result that was created by a court case called Olsberg, and it's been followed by some other cases, but we call it the Olsberg Doctrine. It created a presumption that we think is very contrary to what most people who make wills and trusts in Oregon would consider to be their intent. It creates a presumption of intent for people who make a will that, and this is only if it takes effect in the divorce context, but in that context, it says that it's presumed that if you name somebody in a will and you don't say that you did not intend to name somebody else, then it's presumed that, that in a divorce that the surviving spouse contributed to that property. And when I work with estate planning clients, they're very surprised to hear that, that if they make a will that says I give my estate to my children, and then later on one of those children inherits that property and then gets divorced, the court will interpret that will that the parent who made the gift intended to benefit not only the child, but the child's divorced spouse. So all this bill is doing is just changing that presumption. The Oregon law before the Olsburg case was decided, the presumption was that it was not marital property. So the Olsburg Doctrine fails to reflect both the law and practice of wills and trusts in Oregon and elsewhere, and it sets a standard that's almost impossible to meet. And therefore, it treats the vast majority of inheritances as marital assets that are subject to a presumption of equal division, and it injects this unintended person who is a former in-law as a beneficiary of a trust or an estate, which is contrary to the intent of virtually all settlors of trusts or testators of wills. So I would support the passage of this bill. Thank you, Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Bill? Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Bill Howe. I'm a partner in Gewurz Menasche, which is the largest family law firm in the state. I've had the privilege of working with Mr. Lepetsky, one of the finest family law lawyers in the state, for many years. We were involved with the Oregon Task Force on Family Law. The reason I wanted to testify is to put this in a little larger context. I was one of the lawyers in the Supreme Court case called Kunz, in which the Supreme Court dealt with this issue of separately acquired property. I've spoken around the world because of various organizations I'm a member on this issue. What's interesting is that Oregon is a very small minority jurisdiction where separately acquired property, which means premarital property, gifts, inheritances, are part of the marital estate. If you go to, I'm confused in directions, but if you go to Washington, you receive a gift or inheritance, it's out of the marital estate. Court has no jurisdiction. Go to California, court has no jurisdiction. England, Australia. I think we're one of only 8 states in the U.S. For the good reason, sometimes the judge feels, look, you've been married 20 years. We don't want one party walking away a millionaire because of an inheritance that the parties have relied on and the other have nothing. Along comes Olsburg, a very fine trial judge in our Court of Appeals who does a fantastic job, felt compelled by the rules to require that the presumption of equal contribution apply. Now let's think about this practically. What they're saying is, Dad says, I want property to go to my child. Dad didn't say, I want property to go to my child, but not his wife at the time they're happily married. Olsburg says, unless you have but not to wife, there's a presumption that the testator, Dad, intended it to go both ways. And how do you rebut that presumption? Well, Dad's dead, so it's a problem. If you walk out on the street and stop the first 12 people and say, if a will says property to my children, does that include an ex-spouse? They're going to look at you and say, what are you talking about? So what we've got is this kind of wrinkle that arose, and what this bill does, just to be clear, is eliminates the presumption. It does not say that the court does not have jurisdiction. Let's say the marital estate's $100,000 and the inheritance is $1 million. And so the trial judge feels, I've got to dip into that inheritance a little to make a just and proper division. Does not say the court can't do that. What this says is we're not going to apply a presumption
of equal contribution. It just removes it from that. I strongly support this bill, and I think it would make ORS 105 comport with common sense, which is always a good idea for the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Always a good idea, but not always the reality.
That's true.
No, Mr. Chair, actually, I understand this bill.
Excellent. All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward today. Was there anyone else who wants to give testimony on 386? Not seeing anyone. We'll close that public hearing. And we're going to open up a public hearing on 387. And before you make your comments, I will just say that this is going to be another one of those really technical bills. And we're just going to rely on the presenters today to walk us through it. And let's see. Eric Weiland, Lane Shutterly, and Roy. I'm not even going to try Roy, your last name. You're going to have to help me because I can't read.
Abramowitz.
Abramowitz? Okay. AB? Okay.
Mr. Chair, could I bring my good friend Tim Martinez up too?
Yes, you may. Lane, it's good to see you as always.
Good to see you, Mr. Chair.
Hey, Mr. Chair, for the record, Lane Shutterly here today. I'm an attorney in practice in Dallas, here today in my capacity as a commissioner from Oregon on the National Conference of Commissioners of Uniform State Laws, the Uniform Principal and Income Act, which this bill amends and updates, is a product of the National Conference. The National Conference is a body appointed by the various states. Oregon has four commissioners to the conference. We meet on an ongoing basis and annually. We promulgate uniform laws with the intention that they be passed out to the states for the states to adopt, and in doing that, create a more or less uniform system of laws in the areas governed by the uniform laws, intended to facilitate interstate commerce and, in this case, trust administration, things like anatomical gifts, all sorts of things where uniformity between states is important in the application of laws. The Uniform Principal and Income Act was adopted by the by NACUSL in 1931. It was updated in 1962 and then last updated in 2008 to deal with changes in practicalities governing trust administration and the allocation of principal and interest, and also changes in tax law that are important to keep up with. I should say that the Uniform Principal and Income Act, the 1962 version, has been adopted by 43 states, so it is very substantially uniform. This 2008 update has already been adopted by 19 states, and there are five enactments this year. So this one, too, is moving toward substantial uniform adoption among the states. It's an important area where we want to be uniform, given the interstate nature of trust administration and tax law in particular. And so I commend it to you as a commissioner from NACUSL as a good product for Oregon to adopt to update our own version of the Uniform Principal and Income Act. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will leave it to the experts to tell you more about it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Wieland. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here on behalf of the Estate Planning Section of the Oregon State Bar to testify in support of Senate Bill 387. After the Uniform Principal and Income Act was amended in 2008, an Oregon work group consisting of attorneys, bankers, CPAs, and professional fiduciaries met together and relied heavily on Lane as well as staff for the National Conference of Commissioners to, one, understand what the amendment that was passed in 2008 was and to see how it should be implemented for Oregon or if it should. It was during this work group meetings that we kind of came together and said that we should embrace the amendments presented by the National Conference of Commissioners as well as add one other. The additional amendment would be to add the section for the Uniform Principal and Income Act to the current Oregon statute, so that way when practitioners are trying to interpret the Oregon statutes, they can easily refer back to the actual Uniform Principal and Income Act code. One of the amendments that was that we encourage you to pass, that was passed by the Uniform or the National Conference of Commissioners, helps ensure that when we have a marital trust that was created upon a spouse's death that's for the benefit of their surviving spouse, that they're able to delay estate or inheritance tax until the second spouse's death, a Q-tip trust, that if inside that trust is a qualified plan, retirement account, even annuity, that because of certain IRS tax laws, under the old section, we weren't following the IRS safe harbor laws. And as a result, that trust, which was designed to avoid tax at the first death, that was there to provide for the surviving spouse under some decisions or statements by the IRS, could be challenged and they could lose that tax benefit. We basically, in this amendment, help bring the Oregon law back into the Safe Harbor Act, which will allow those plannings to take place.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Roy Abramowitz. I'm a partner with Perkins & Company, a CPA firm in Portland, and I'm representing the Oregon Society of CPAs. There's a second part of this amendment that reconnects to the Uniform Principal Income Act. It is, and it amends ORS 129.420, and it deals with trusts that hold entity that holds interests in pass-through entities, for example, partnerships, LLCs, and S corporations. The problem that is in the current legislation is that it's ambiguous as to how a trustee can deal with sometimes a dilemma that arises when, for example, which actually often happens with these pass-through entities, the income that is reported, the taxable income that's reported on the K-1 is often a lot more than the cash is actually distributed from the entity. And it's the cash that is taken out, is generally wanted by the income beneficiary. So the dilemma arises is how to allocate and make sure there's enough tax left in the trust to pay the tax that that arises from the taxable income. So this bill, this legislation gives the trustee some flexibility and cleans up the language a little bit in order to make it easier for the trustee to allocate and apply the taxes both to income, principal, or both in a proportionate manner. So, again, we encourage passage of this legislation as it makes practitioners' life a little easier in applying the law and conforms to the UPIA. Thank you very much, and we appreciate your listening to us today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. As you look to the certified smart people to my left, you know I'm not here for that. I'm here to provide color, and I'm happy to be here today. I have submitted testimony from Linda Thomas Bush, who is a vice president and senior trust officer at U.S. Bank. She unfortunately could not be here today. She runs all four of their locations around the state as well as others. But I think she does a good job of summarizing in just a few words what all these gentlemen have said, and we very much support the passage of this legislation, and I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for the color.
The flip note version.
Yeah. Gilbert's, we call it. Okay, any questions, comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much for
thank
coming
you.
Forward. Anyone else who'd like to give testimony on 387? Not seeing anyone come forward, we'll close that public hearing. We're now going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 419.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 419 narrows the definition of abuse that involves speech in the Elderly Persons and Persons with Disabilities Abuse Prevention Act. Senate Bill 419 responds to a circuit court opinion out of Clackamas County, which held that the provision at issue, ORS 124005 sub 1 sub E, was constitutionally overbroad.
All right, thank you. I have three people that have signed up. Bob Jundoff, Rick Bennett, and Sybil Hebb. Would three of you come forward? While they're coming forward, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on Senate Bill 419? Good morning, whoever would like to start.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundoff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And I'm here today speaking for Disability Rights Oregon as well as the Developmental Disabilities Coalition. We are not proponents of this bill, and I don't believe that anyone sitting at this table is a proponent of the bill. And so what I'm speaking to really, and as I signed up as a neutral party, is that as we looked over the wording of this bill, we had some concerns about it, and really it has to do with how one interprets the language in the bill. As I understand, this bill came to you because of an opinion, a court opinion coming out of Clackamas County District Circuit Court, which found that the existing language was violated the constitutional rights of freedom of speech. As we read the language of the existing statute, we can understand how it could be interpreted in a variety of ways. The circuit court in Clackamas County decided that it would be interpreted in one way. We think that that particular opinion could go in different directions if it reached the appellate courts. Having said that, when we looked at the new language, we had similar confusion about exactly what the language in the bill means and doesn't mean. And this brings some renewed concern on our part that perhaps we haven't really worked through exactly what the policy is underlying the language in the bill so that we can craft the language to be not only constitutional but to get at the problem that we're trying to address. And the problem is that we have people who are vulnerable because of their disability or their age, and that speech can be used as a weapon to intimidate that person, to put that person in fear, and to cause them emotional or physical harm. And that is what the law recognizes. However, the question is, how do we get to that in the right way? Part of our concern has to do with the questions of, are we talking about what type of intent are we looking at from the perpetrator? What, in other words, does the perpetrator, when presented with a vulnerable victim, does the law prohibit them from doing things that they think would intimidate the average person, any person, or the specific person to whom that language is directed? And secondly, does the person involved matter? In other words, if language is used that would not upset the average person, but would and is tailored to upset the vulnerable person, is that what we're getting at, or are we using objective standards? And are we saying that if language wouldn't upset the average person, then we don't have a problem? To give an illustrative story about this, we have had a situation in which a care provider, in order to keep a person in their bedroom, told that person, this is a person with limited intellectual abilities, that there were wolves outside the door, and that if that person came outside, that the wolves would get them. Now, you or I would most likely not believe that there are wolves outside the door. However, that person was placed in extreme fear as a result of that, and the person who used that technique knew it. So that's the type of situation that we think this particular law is actually designed to address, where a person is intentionally using language that might that may or may not be objectively seen as harmful, but certainly is when you look at the context of the situation. And balancing that against free speech rights is really what we're trying to deal with. All of that having been said, our problem is that it's very difficult for us to look at the language and see if it's addressing that type of situation or not. And so we'd like to back off and have an opportunity to craft language that's specifically designed to get at the problem, and that we have a legislative record that supports the need for that type of restriction. One last point, and I'll conclude. We have an interesting legislative structure here in which this particular prohibition applies for two purposes. One is for the purpose of getting a restraining order. Any individual can go and file to get a restraining order against someone else from continuing with that behavior. It's also used for mandatory abuse reporting for seniors and people with disabilities. And these are, and they're very closely related, but they're two different policy purposes. One is to allow an individual to create some protection for themselves and remove an abuser from the home. The second one triggers an investigation from government that looks at a situation in order to objectively find out what's going on. And if necessary, the government agency can then take steps to provide what are called protective services to protect the person from further harm. So we have the same definition being used in both contexts, and there may be some different policy reasons behind those. So you hear in my voice a lot of feeling of complexity in this area, and we go in and mess around with the language. I think it's important for us to know exactly why we're doing it, not in response to a single circuit court opinion that hasn't made its way through the appellate courts.
Before we take other testimony, my question is that case actually on appeal?
My understanding is it is not.
All right. Who would like to go next?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. I echo Mr. Junedef's comments, and from the Law Center's perspective, this form of protection is very important to our clients. Elderly people with disabilities are especially vulnerable, and this does provide them with a form of relief that can provide them from protection. And so we are very interested in the way this discussion develops, tend to agree that there are probably some there are some constitutional questions related to the current statute. I don't pretend to know what the exact answers are. I agree with the questions that Mr. Junedef raised that should be considered in analyzing what the right fix would be. I would also just add a couple of other questions. One of the decisions that was relied on by the Circuit Court in Clackamas County is an Oregon Supreme Court case called Rangel. That case sets a very high bar for any First Amendment speech and limitations on that speech. That was a case that was interpreting a criminal statute for the purposes of whether or not a person could be convicted. That's, I think, a slightly different analysis when you're looking at a civil protection order that's merely limiting the time and place and manner of your speech, especially, and so there's a difference, I think, although I don't pretend to be a constitutional scholar, but I think there could be said to be a difference in the analysis that would be applied in a civil context. Also, I think where, and Bob spoke about this as well, where you're looking at the impact of speech on people as opposed to what the content of speech was, there are some cases that talk about the difference in analysis between those two questions, and then further, the impact of speech on vulnerable populations, and how does that get taken into consideration. The other piece that I would mention is that the civil protection order statute that is amended by this bill has two forms of relief, and one is a protection order and the other is a civil cause of damages. And I think the analysis with respect to what would give rise to a civil cause of damages would be even further different from the analysis of what could be used to trigger prohibitions on speech. So I'm mostly raising questions. I don't have good answers. I do think that the Court of Appeals has been grappling with some of these questions in the context of protection orders recently. My feeling is that they've looked at this and know a lot more about this than I do, and I would be wary of moving forward too quickly on the basis of a circuit court decision that hasn't made its way through that process. So,
right, thank you.
Thank you.
Rick?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. As Bob indicated, we signed, all of us signed up as neutral. I think that's because there's no column that says don't know. And certainly, Bob and Sybil are much more informed and knowledgeable than I am on the law. I would just indicate, kind of as Mr. Martinez did on the previous bill, that I'm here for color and to lend moral support. Our counsel did review the court case in question and the bill, and I guess we can just say we understand the constitutional question. We're also very concerned about the impact related to protection of seniors and people with disabilities. And at this point, we're not quite sure whether this bill and the language in the bill is the correct way to go, or whether in fact some other action is perhaps a better way. In this case, letting the work through the court system and so forth. So, as I said, we're concerned about the impact that the ruling might have on seniors and people with disabilities. Not quite sure whether this is the appropriate mechanism at the moment.
All right, Rick, thank you for the color. I took your statement as a motion, so I went ahead on my own as a prerogative of the chair. The neutral column in this one says don't. So, all right, questions? Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, and thank you for the testimony. When I read the current language, I question whether there's a constitutional issue there, quite honestly. I don't think there is, but I'm not a constitutional scholar either. And then I read the amended language. I'm not sure that it makes it better. It may actually make it worse. And I guess, Ms. Chair, I'm wondering if we are fixing a problem that we aren't sure actually exists yet at this point.
Sir Wissett?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm along the same line. Does anyone at the panel there have an opinion as to why this hasn't been appealed? Is that because they believe that the decision was correct, or I mean, why isn't it working through the courts instead of coming back to the legislature?
Chair Przanski, Senator Wood said, it's a good question. I think in reading the decision and looking at what the decision reflected as to the facts of the case, and so the result of the decision was that the request for the protection order was denied. And I think that was the right decision based on the facts, my humble opinion. I'm not the judge, but and so the person who would have had to appeal it would have been the person who lost that order. I don't think that they would sustain that.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Wood said, I'd add that, as Sybil said, is that case was decided on narrow grounds that correct, but the judge made a decision to also rule on a larger question, which I think the parties really didn't have a particular interest in resolving.
No one really has standing to appeal it.
No, they had standing, but they just wouldn't have an interest to worry about resolving the constitutional question when under the facts of the case it seemed correct.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I also have a question. What, on a practical level, for the people in the courtroom in that circuit court, what's the value of that decision? Is it going to affect other circuit court judges in that county?
The county.
Is that an open question?
Mr. Chair, committee counsel.
Is there any, I should say?
I don't think there's any binding precedential value. It's a reference point.
Right. Yeah. Before you do that, my understanding, because we had a similar decision in the sense of another context that happened in Lane County, and it's not binding on all the circuit court judges in that county, but it is referenced as a decision that potentially you could get the conflict of going the opposite direction than what the first court did. Senator Bowman-Meacham.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if any of you know if this statute has been interpreted in other cases in the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I did a quick review of the case law, and it hasn't been, as far as I've been able to find.
Yep.
I agree.
All right. Any other questions, comments? With that, thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give us any more insight on Senate Bill 419. Not hearing anyone coming forward.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask counsel, what's this act, the Elderly Persons and Persons with Disability Abuse Prevention Act, when was that enacted and what was the vehicle?
When was it enacted? I'm afraid I might have to get back to you with
that'd be fine.
An answer.
Okay. We'll do that.
When was the underlying language enacted?
When was the act enacted? Yeah. All right. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 419. We're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing on 450.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 450 creates an evidentiary privilege to keep communications between minors and parents confidential.
All right. Thank you. We have five people that have scheduled to give testimony or signed up. Gail Meyer and Kathy Berger, why don't y'all come first? And just to give a framework, this is a bill that I have put in. The reason I put it in because I had had a contact who, from a, at that time, practicing attorney, he's now sitting on the bench in Blaine County, and basically brought this to my attention, and I thought it was worth us having another discussion about it. So with that...
Mr. Chair, didn't we, I'm like having deja vu, didn't we work on this issue last session?
We did.
So can you tell, I'd be curious to know how this is different. I thought we had taken action. But
We took action in the Senate. It went to the House. It did not go anywhere in the House. It actually went to a different committee than what most people thought it would have gone to. And there's a lot of opportunities to try to amend it, come up to some compromise, /. And that failed, and it was supposed to be worked on during the interim.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Chair Prozanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we would like to thank Chair Prozanski for presenting the bill again. We do support the bill. Sometimes at the beginning of a analysis of the bill, it's hard to find the point of agreement amongst everyone, but this one is easy. I think everyone would agree that we want kids to trust their parents and we want them to confide in them. The question presented really by the bill here and the policy issue is what to do if or when those communications have legal consequence, if they're of interest in a legal proceeding, then what do we do? Do we consider the sanctity of the parent-child relationship important enough to say that it should remain confidential, or do we say the government has the right to intrude into that relationship and force disclosures over both of their objections? Right now, Oregon does not have a privilege for a confidential communication made by a child to their parent. Three states do, Idaho, Massachusetts, and Minnesota. Senate Bill 450 is most closely mirrored off the Minnesota statute, but I will say that our Ledge Council did a much better job writing it out. The privilege is also recognized by judicial ruling in New York. But the majority of states do not have it, and the question presented here is, should Oregon join those that do? Oregon, of course, recognizes confidential communications in a host of other relationships that perhaps may or may not be considered as sacred, clergy relationships, physicians, attorneys, and spouses. The bill, I think, has very sensible limitations and exceptions, and I think it's important just perhaps to highlight those. There's no privilege where the parent-child relationship has already broken down or is already in a damaged state. So in proceedings, in legal proceedings where it's alleged that the parent is not serving the best interests of the child, then the privilege does not exist. Examples would be juvenile dependency hearings, including termination of parental rights, criminal or civil actions against the parent, for child abuse, child neglect, abandonment, or non-support. The privilege would not exist when there's allegations of abuse within the home. So if the child is charged with a crime against a parent or another child in the home, or if the parent is charged with a crime against the child or against another parent or another child of either parent, then so if there's abuse in the home, then the privilege would not exist. It doesn't exist in civil actions between parents or between the parent and the child, and it doesn't exist in proceedings of commitment or protective proceedings. So where the relationship is already broken down, or where there's an allegation of abuse within the home, or civil actions between the parents, then the privilege doesn't exist. And I think an important feature here is the one that's contained in subsection 3. The privilege is not inviolate. It can be waived. It can be waived by either the child making the communication or the parent to whom it was made. So if the parent says, you know what, can't sit on this, I've got to come forward with this, the parent has the authority to say, this is a communication I need to share. And so it's not as though we would forbid either of them to speak. It's not like the spousal privilege in that respect. The child or the parent can elect to share the disclosure. The question is, can government force them to do it if both of them want to keep it confidential? We want kids who are in trouble to seek their aid, the counsel, and the advice of their parents. We want them to trust their parents, and we want their parents to act parentally to serve and protect the best needs of the child. And we think Senate Bill 450 does that, and we support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. My name is Kathy Berger. I am a criminal defense attorney. Since 1990, I've been representing juveniles in delinquency proceedings. As a side note, just to let you know my other involvement in terms of juvenile delinquency, I am also a member of the Oregon Youth Authority Advisory Board, and on the Juvenile Justice Steering Committee, I am the defense representative to that committee. I speak frequently both all over Oregon and all over the country on juvenile delinquency matters, and I have written extensively on juvenile delinquency matters. I am here in my capacity as an OCDLA member supporting this bill to let you know how this works in terms of when somebody is representing a child. When I start to represent a child, what the first thing I have to tell any child is you cannot speak to anyone about anything that happened, including your parents. I have to tell the parents that I cannot meet with them and the child and discuss the allegations against the child together in the same room. I cannot tell parents what their child has told me regarding the allegations, which makes it very difficult when I of a child who is wanting advice from his or her parents about what he or she should do regarding the delinquency action that they're facing. Certainly I ask the parents to give advice, but I can't give the parents all the information, or the child can't give the parents all of the information that parent may need to help the child along. Now, there's two decades of research that shows us that children, biologically, because their brains are not completely developed, do not make good decisions. They especially don't make good decisions when they are in situations that are emotionally laden. They don't make good decisions when they are with other teenagers or they are getting the advice from other teenagers. For those two reasons, that's why this legislature has developed the graduated driver's license program, which has been extremely successful because we recognize that teenagers, especially young teenagers, don't make good decisions on their own. The decisions that they're worst at, absolutely worst at, is being able to figure out alternatives. Often what happens is teenagers see one course of action and only one course of action and have difficulties moving off of that one course of action and seeing options that they have. And that's what we look to adults to give children that guidance. It's the guidance that parents give their kids every single day. You know, just because all of your friends are cutting school, that does not mean you're going to cut school. And I don't care that their parents are letting them cut school, I'm not going to let you cut school. And therefore, I'm going to put my foot down and I'm going to exercise parental authority to make sure that you are not making a bad decision. It's a decision that we expect parents to make. In fact, when parents aren't making those decisions, oftentimes we look at dependency actions against those parents, especially if their inability to help their their children or direct their children is putting their children into danger, except when their child is alleged to have committed an act which would have been a crime if they were an adult. At that point, we say to parents, because we aren't going to allow you confidential communication and you speaking to your child might end up with you on the witness stand testifying against your child, I have to put an end to it. I can't make a witness against one of my clients, which means I have difficulties. And this plays out in a couple of ways. I often will have clients that tell me one thing and tell their parents something completely different. I mean, anybody that's dealt with a teenager is going to believe that that's going to be the case. So the parent then wonders why me, as a lawyer, is advocating one particular point of view because their child is telling them something completely different. The most effective way for me to deal with that situation would be to get both the parent and the child in the room together and work through with them what is really going on. I can't do that. I am ethically obligated not to do that because that communication would not be confidential and the parent could be called as a witness. The other way this plays out is that you have a situation where the parent is in complete denial of what's going on and they could hear from everybody in the world, this is what your child has done, and they're not going to believe it until they hear it from their own child's mouth. And that's what we allow to happen after a child is adjudicated, but that's not the time. The time that the parent needs to be a parent is throughout the entire process. Research shows that the children who do the best after a delinquency adjudication are those that have the support of a family structure. Those are the children that do the best in juvenile court, and that's immediately what we're stopping as soon as they come to see me. I think you need to take into account, you need to remember a couple of things here. First of all, most children in the state of Oregon do not get delinquency actions. Most of them don't, okay? Most kids who are charged with delinquency actions don't go far into the juvenile justice system. They skirt the edges of it, but they don't go deep into the system. So we're not talking about that this is going to open the floodgates and there's going to be lots of situations where this situation comes up. I can remember, actually, since 1990, in all the delinquency cases that I have done in that period of time, three times where a district attorney was interested in calling the parent as a witness. Three times. And in each of those cases, the case resolved without the parent having to take the stand. So out of all the cases that I had, there were three times that the state might have needed that parent's testimony or evidence from that parent in order to make the case. And in all the other cases, I had to keep the parents away from their child and stop that communication. I think that the best public policy is to allow parents and children to have the confidential communication if they need to have it so parents can help their child, especially when their child is having problems.
Thank you. Senator Bonamici first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the definition of, I think it's a definition, where it says a communication is confidential when the communication is made out of the presence of all persons other than the child's siblings or grandparents. And I wanted to ask about the sibling or grandparent part, because what if you had a parent, I understand your policy reason for you saying that this communication should be confidential. What if you had a parent who really needed to talk to the 17-year-old, but you've got a 16-year-old in the room? So I have some concerns about what happens then to that 16-year-old who's going to go put something on Facebook or something. I just wonder why that language is in there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, not having drafted it, I don't know. My guess is it's a situation where if you have in the family home a child saying something, blurting it out in the midst of in the family home and the people who are living in the family home, where the parent doesn't have the opportunity to then pull that child aside and talk to that child privately, that the communication covers that situation where it's in the family home and the initial statement is made in the family home where there might have been others that overheard that.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Bonamici, and I would agree. I think it's designed to capture those moments of disclosure where it might be in the kitchen and there might be someone in the other room who does overhear it. I would just reference the Minnesota statute. It reads that a communication is confidential if made out of the presence of persons not members of the child's immediate family living in the same household.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, two questions. This bill appears to be retroactive. I would like to hear a little discussion about what particular pitfalls that might cause if something is already in court or a court had already ruled on a subject. And the second part is, why would a communication with a child and the parent not be considered hearsay evidence and excluded from any court action anyway?
Chair Pozanski and Senator Whitsitt, thank you for the questions. As to the retroactivity, it would impact cases currently pending before grand jury, et cetera. I'm sure you will pose that question to one of the next witnesses, whom I know will be addressing that feature. If this were to become law and to be prospective only, we would not be complaining about that. We think it would be a good policy choice to go forward with, and if there are ramifications to current cases unfolding, I think that's something to take into consideration. Your question as to why would it not be hearsay, there's an exception to the hearsay rule if someone is making an admission as to a crime. So if someone says to someone else, I committed a bank robbery on Friday, that can be disclosed in a criminal case, even in a civil case, against me to prove that, in fact, I did commit a bank robbery last Friday. It's a declaration against self-interest or penal interest, and it's a recognized exception.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Our next panel, I believe it's Charlie Woods, if I got the last name, Jason Carlisle, and Scott Healy. Yes. We'll get there. Good morning. As y'all are getting set, we have about 21 minutes before we end. I have one other bill, so if y'all can just expedite and make sure we get through what y'all need to get on the record, and then we'll take questions after that.
Good morning, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. My name is Charlene Woods. And I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I supervise our child abuse team. I'm also here with ODAA today. And I would urge the committee to consider three amendments to Senate Bill 450 that would accomplish three different things. First, I think it's important that this new privilege not apply in child abuse cases. Secondly, that it not apply in homicide cases. And thirdly, that it not be applied retroactively. First, I would like to talk about the child abuse exception. I would urge the committee to write the bill in such a way that this new privilege would not apply to any civil action, criminal action, or delinquency proceeding alleging child abuse or neglect. And I'd like to give some concrete everyday examples of how this law as presently written could impact our ability to effectively prosecute some child abuse cases. For example, as is currently written in subsection 2.4F, if a child is charged with a crime or an act of delinquency against a child of either parent, this privilege does not apply. But I would argue that is too narrow the way it is presently written. For example, if a 16-year-old child sodomizes a foster child who's living in his or her home, or a niece or nephew or cousin, or even the next door neighbor's child when they're babysitting that child. The way this law is currently written, if that 16-year-old tells his or her parent, I did sodomize my cousin or the next door neighbor or my niece or nephew, that statement to his or her parent cannot be used in the prosecution for that crime. And I would submit that that niece, nephew, cousin, foster child, or next-door neighbor's child is worthy as much protection under the law as is the offending child's sibling or half-sibling. So I think the law is too narrow and just making the privilege not applicable if it's the child's sibling or half-sibling who is the victim. Another example, the child, this bill is presently written, only states that this evidence confidentiality privilege is not applicable if the parent is prosecuted with a crime against the child or the child's sibling or half-sibling. Again, I would argue that that is too narrow, and a real-world example would be, say, a four-year-old child tells their mother that the mother's live-in boyfriend has been sexually abusing them. The live-in boyfriend actually confesses to the police. Later at trial, the four-year-old becomes unavailable as a witness due to their young age. Presently, there's an evidence code exception, 803-18AB, that would let us get in that four-year-old's statements to her mother about being abused by that person so we could corroborate his confession to the police and sustain a conviction. As this bill is presently written, since it's not the parent is being prosecuted, but mother's live-in boyfriend, the defense could argue, hey, what this four-year-old child told her mother is privileged, and this mother doesn't want to testify about that because, unfortunately, it is not uncommon for a non-offending parent to sometimes want to protect the abuser and not their child. They want to preserve their relationship with their boyfriend, etc. So the way it's currently written, we may not be able to use that four-year-old child's statements to her mother. Another example, a child goes to their parents, their mother and father, and says, paternal uncle has been sexually abusing me, or he physically abused me. The parents do not report that to the police. They try to handle it within the family. The abuse continues. The child eventually goes to a school and reports to the school what their paternal uncle has been doing, and the investigation goes forward. Likewise, since it's the paternal uncle who would be being prosecuted and not a parent, the parents could argue, we don't have to testify about what our child told us about what happened. And that could undermine our ability to get a successful prosecution in that particular case. So the way I would urge that this present bill be amended is that in section 24E, which is on page 1, line 31, eliminate the words, quote, of either parent. On section 24F, which is on page 2, line 2.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask you to put that in writing to us.
Okay, we'll I'll be happy to do that,
Chair. Like I said, I've got about 7 minutes to conclude the testimony and questions. So if you anything that you want to do in the way of an amendment, if you can put it in writing, we can have it and grasp it that way instead of trying to put it in the record.
Thank you, Chair. I will be happy to do that. I'll also put in the record then that another section that I recommend be amended, ORS 419B.040, another section of the criminal code.
I understand that, Charlene.
Okay.
I'm very serious about this. I have six minutes, and I'm going to cut this off. I want to give everyone an opportunity. And we have some questions, I believe, that are going to be asked. So you can put that in writing. I'm more than willing. All of us will get it. It will be part of the record, and it will be easier for us to digest it and take it into any type of amendments we may want to consider.
Understood, Chair Przanski. Thank you very much. I also urge that the committee adopt a homicide exception. So in the cases where a person has actually been murdered, the state has a real interest in making sure those cases are effectively prosecuted, and that a statement, say, a 17-year-old makes about having committed a homicide to their parent could be used in court. I also would urge the committee not to make this retroactive because it's possible that current cases that have already been indicted, there could be an argument that the grand jury heard testimony that is no longer admissible, and perhaps those indictments could be collaterally attacked. So I would urge it be prospective only. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Jason, are you
there? Thank you, Senator Przanski. I'll meet your time limit.
Okay.
And members of the committee. Let me take a step back and give you a little bit of a...
Jason just needed
Jason Cardall, Lynn County DA, here for the ODA. Most of the privileges that we have are codification of the common law which means there's a lot of experience and real-life teaching that's been associated with our current codified privileges. This is a new creature, and our fear is that it will create unintended consequences, many of which my colleague has just talked to you about, so I won't repeat those. So we need to go very, very carefully, and as written, it's our fear that it's just too dangerous and too broad. It creates things that we just don't anticipate, and it'll hurt people because of its broadness. For example, all of our current privileges are limited by 419B040, which says, in the case of abuse of a child, these shall not be grounds for excluding the evidence. And this privilege won't even be limited by the same statute that limits all the other privileges. So this creates kind of a super privilege, and we're concerned that that will just go too far. My colleague Scott Healy from Clackamas County might have an example or two, and then I've got another suggested amendment to think about. I'll be brief. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you,
members
of
the committee.
Scott.
Good morning, Chair Prusansky, members of the committee. In the interest of time, I echo, of course, what my two esteemed colleagues have just said with regard to this bill.
I need to have you put your name.
Oh, I apologize. My name's Scott Healy. I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Clackamas County. I have been for going on 17 and a half years or so. I was a member of our person crimes unit for almost 15 years, and I probably handled between 500 and 1,000 child sex abuse cases, as well as other very serious cases in our county. Anyway, I will try to be brief because it's interesting. If I would have gone first, I probably would have said a number of the things that the first two witnesses just said. I guess one thing I want to point out is that I don't think that this exception contemplates mandatory reporters. What if one of the, you know, the parent that's being disclosed to is either a teacher, a nurse, a doctor, a lawyer, a counselor, and of course there's a mandatory reporter statute. You can look at the list. There's a number of other people that are mandatory reporters. So it would be in conflict with that. That's something that needs to be contemplated. And just to give two case examples, and I'll be done, Chair Prusansky, is that there was, and they're both from Washington County, there was a recent, and they've both been adjudicated. There was a recent case where a 16-year-old offender was having sex with his 12-year-old sister in the home, and he was a registered sex offender because he had previously been convicted in juvenile court 2 years prior to that when he was having sex with that same victim. He had gone through the juvenile system and was now back in the home and found to be having sex with his little sister again. Both the parents found out about it. They interviewed, of course, or talked to both the victim and the offender, and it was some time before ultimately it was reported. In fact, I think it was ultimately reported because the victim disclosed to a counselor, not by the parents. So that would be a situation where, you know, arguably, certainly the statements that the victim makes to the parents would be protected. And I think the other thing I want to make clear, because I don't know that it was clear, when the people that were in support of the bill testified, is that this exception can be enforced by both parties. It can be enforced by, you know, the parent, but it can also be enforced by the victim or anybody that might be representing the victim as well. So I recall a statement that, you know, if a defendant comes home, say, from an armed robbery, a 17-year-old defendant comes home and has committed an armed robbery, and I've actually had a case just like this, and makes statements to the father, the defendant in this case, can actually enforce the privilege against the father, and so the father wouldn't be able to testify with regard to any confessing statements that, in fact, the defendant, the 17-year-old armed robber defendant, made to his father. He would be able to stop that testimony at trial, and that would be concerning. One other case in Washington County, there was, back in 2003, there was an aggravated murder case where a 17-year-old defendant entered a home to burglarize, assault, and then ultimately murdered the adult male in the home, and then tried to murder the 5-year-old son by stabbing, slitting his throat, and hitting him with a blunt object. The 17-year-old was living with his dad at the time. He came and made some statements to the father. The father was cooperative and did testify at grand jury. Ultimately, the case, I believe, was resolved by plea. But arguably, with this exception, the 17-year-old in that very serious case could have enforced the privilege against his father, and his father would not have been able to testify at grand jury to any admissions or confession that he made or at trial. And so that could have gone a long way towards hindering the prosecution in that case. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the time.
What we're going to do is we're going to recess 450 for right now. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 489. We'll come back for questions right after this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 489 requires court to honor parties' written stipulation to continue certain domestic relations proceedings absent a finding that injustice would result by a clear and convincing standard.
Bill, thank you for being here. And Robin, whoever wants to start off.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Thank you, Senators Bonamici and Dingfelder, for introducing the bill, and Senator Bonamici for the help of your staff in moving it on. We have provided written testimony that will be circulated. I won't repeat what's in there. I'm going to give you a couple of examples of why this bill is necessary. Bill Howen, I'm a partner at Gewurz Menashe. Robin Wright works with me at Gewurz Menashe. We are one of the largest family law firms actually in the country. This is a problem that comes up rarely, but real life situation, 5 or 6 days before trial, parties are having a dispute over parenting. Custody evaluation has been done at the request of both parties. The evaluator's mother dies in Iowa. Evaluator gets on a plane, is scheduled to be at a funeral of her mother on the day of trial. The trial, the presiding judge won't reset the case because it's beyond the one-year guideline. Second case, recently, one of the lawyers in our office has. Parties want to reconcile. They go to their counselor. The counselor says, you folks are not in a position to decide whether to get married or stay married or not. The presiding judge won't reset the case. Most presiding judges are very reasonable. Most judges in this state are outstanding. Our Chief Justice has done a magnificent job in the very difficult task of managing the court system. Most lawyers that we've talked to outside the valley can't even understand what we're talking about, because in smaller jurisdictions the courts are just much more flexible. This is partly just driven by time. It is somewhat ironic, having been appointed by the governor in 93 to chair the Oregon Task Force in Family Law, much of the family law procedure are things that I was involved in writing. At that time, family law cases were the crazy aunt in the basement that we were trying to force into priority. And ironically, then Chief Justice Carson passed this rule saying we're going to try to get all family law cases resolved in 9 months, absolutely in a year, which, you know, has ended up having this unanticipated result. And those judges that have ruled to force cases to trial are not doing it because they're nasty and bad people, but there's a kind of scorekeeping that's going on. And there is no rule that allows us to take these cases where the parties have a legitimate need. Family law cases are different. These parties have love. They often have children. It's a complex transaction. If you read the literature, there's an emotional divorce. There's a physical divorce. There's a legal divorce. The judicial system is involved only in a legal divorce. Very often, people are living together at the time they're going through a divorce, and they're going to counseling. And when those three divorces happen is often a very different time. We, in this, our statutes require the parties to cooperate, to come up with parenting plans, to decide when to file parenting plans. So many things the statutes obligate the parties to do. And, of course, the parties decide when to file. The parties can dismiss without the court's permission. Isn't it odd that the only thing the parties can't do is decide when their case is ready for a trial or hearing? And that's all this bill says. If both parties agree, and the court does not find by clear and convincing evidence that injustice would result, the case must be reset which basically just takes it out of the scorekeeping and lets the parties control it, which is generally good policy. There's no objection to the bill that we've been able to surface. We've talked to everybody we can think of. The Chief Justice asked that the original three-day period for filing the motion be extended to 10, which we have done. There's no fiscal impact, and we're really here speaking on behalf of those folks who don't know today that they're going to get divorced later.
All right. Thank you. Robin,
we urge passage of the bill.
Just a few. One of the things that might not be readily come to mind about these kinds of things.
Have
I'm
you
sorry.
Put your name on the record.
My name's Robin Wright. I'm working with Bill Howe. I'm a lawyer at Gewurztraminer Asching. I've been doing family law for about 8 years. One of the things that's not readily discernible, perhaps, to people who don't practice family law is during the course of the divorce, there are a number of temporary orders that get set. So kind of rules of the game for this proceeding. If you come up to a timeline and your case gets dismissed, a couple of things happen. All of that work gets dissolved. So you cannot, even if you refile your divorce, have those things set over except by agreement of the parties. Requires a lot of work. If people have lawyers, lots of people don't have lawyers, but if people do have lawyers, there are extra charges, there are extra filing fees. So even though it might seem that it's a simple thing to have the case dismissed and be refiled, it costs a lot of time, it costs a lot of effort, and it costs a lot of money to get that done. So it's not an insignificant thing if a judge, as in some jurisdiction says, well, simply dismiss this case and refile and you can have your day in court. The other thing that it creates are some disparities in actual judicial record keeping. Normally, if somebody's in a family law case, you have one case number that you get in that county. That's your case number forever as long as your family law proceedings go on. And these things can potentially go on until your children are age 21 in Oregon. So if you start out with an infant and you get divorced, which is unfortunate, you may still have an operational case for that period of time. If a case is ongoing for that year and then gets dismissed, you will get another file, another case number. That means you may have difficulty figuring out how many cases you have, and it also means your statistics for divorces are interrupted. You don't know if those same two parties have had to refile, get new numbers, those kinds of things. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
We're going to take questions now. I'm running out of time. If there's any other comments or questions on this, makes sense.
And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to note that we have submitted a request for an amendment to change the number of days pursuant to the justice.
Mr. Howell, I need to go back to the other hearing. I think everyone's captured everything. It looks like this bill will be moving forward with amendments. So thank you very much.
Great.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 489, reopen on 450. And if the three panelists want to come back up for questions. Chair's willing to stay here, and if y'all want to set this over and continue tomorrow, I can just roll it over till tomorrow, which actually would be Monday.
Mr. Chair, my preference would be to just go ahead. I think. Mr. Chair, I mentioned that I had a suggestion. You know, you heard some testimony about it makes it tough when a lawyer's trying to counsel a...
I need to go ahead and put the name on since we brought you back.
Okay. Jason Carlisle, Linn County DA. We have a proposed amendment that I think that would solve that problem that messes up the privilege of a lawyer client. And the amendment, we can submit the language for the chair.
I understand that was being worked on from Elizabeth Kushwa, and so we'll definitely take that in. I guess I had a couple of questions, and Scott, I guess the thing in your testimony, it seemed like you are reading the bill that would say that the parent could or the child could object to the parent waiving the privilege. When I look at line 18, I don't read it that way, so I was wondering if you could just clarify that.
May I please the chair and members of the committee, can I just have a moment just to read it?
Oh, sure.
Yeah,
Well, the situation...
And Scott, just if you could put your name on the record again.
I'm sorry. Once again, I apologize. I'm not very good about that.
You're fine. We just need to put the
record. My name's Scott Healy, and I'm a senior deputy DA in Clackamas County. I guess what I'm looking at is I'm looking at the entire bill. Under subsection 2, I'm going to start there at line 10. It says, the privilege created by this section may be claimed by the child or the parent to whom the communication is made. And then I go down to where Chair Przanski just discussed and talked about the privilege created by this section under subsection 3. The privilege created by this section may be waived by express consent to disclosure by express consent to disclosure by the child or the parent to whom the communication is made, or failure of the child or of the parent to whom the communication is made to object to disclosure. I guess the situation that I was talking about, and maybe I didn't make it clear, is that the way that it's written, I believe that if the child, you know, ends up becoming charged with a crime because of whatever the conduct it is that they've disclosed to and perhaps admitted to or confessed to a parent, then...
We'd be rich if we actually had Senator Cruz paying into the education. Maybe I should do the Vicky Walker.
That was the Senator Walker thing.
Yeah. I apologize for the interruption here.
That's okay, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Then arguably, the way it's written, then a lawyer for that, you know, the defendant, the child defendant, could say that those disclosures are privileged with regard to the privilege as it's written. That's how I read it, that argument can be made. If you think that I'm mistaken about that because of subsection 3, then maybe you can explain to me. Yeah. Why do you think I'm mistaken?
When I look at it says the privilege created here may be waived by, and then line 18 and 19, it says express consent to disclose by the child or the parent to whom the communication is made. And so to me, it says that the parent who's received that communication may, in fact, waive that privilege. And I heard your testimony state that the child would be able, or the attorney on behalf of the child, representing the child, would be able to object to that disclosure. And, you know, that's not the intent of what we want. And so we can, you know, again, we'll work on this with all the different suggestions for amendments and move forward. And I'm going to leave it there. I mean, there is some other part on the other part of your testimony about where you have an act that you said was would be abuse within the family of them not being able to testify, and there is another exemption waiver under F where a criminal act in which the child is charged with a crime or act of delinquency committed against the person or property of the parent to whom the communication is made or another child of either parent. And so it seems to me that there are multiple ways that you can have waivers on specific type of facts. But what I want to do is see if there's any other questions, comments from anyone. And then if not, why don't we do this? We can work together, the chair, whoever on this panel, or through Elizabeth, and we'll see what we can come up with. To the committee, thank you very much for staying over. And with that, I'm going to go conclude for today and adjourn. And we're scheduled to be here on Monday at 8:30, and we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 450. Again, thank you for coming back to the table.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.